Well, good morning, everybody. Calling this meeting of the House Committee on Children and Families Finance and Policy to order. So glad to be with folks today. This is an exciting day. We'll be considering, and I'm hoping to pass, several bills that will get an early launch on getting kids off to a great start in our state, which I know is a value that's shared by all of us. We're going to start by having the clerk take the roll and then proceed from there. I should note that we have several members who are out presenting bills and various things, but they'll be catching up with us. Ms. Killian is filling in for our regular committee legislative assistant, Ms. Kahn. Ms. Killian.
Chair Pinto.
Present.
Chair Pinto present. Chair or Vice Chair Hueller.
And she is presenting a bill in another committee. She'll be joining us shortly.
Representative Daniels.
Present.
Daniels present. Representative Bliss.
Present.
Bliss present. Representative Coulter.
Present.
Coulter present. Representative Davis.
Present.
Davis present. Representative Hansen.
Present.
Hansen present. Representative Hemmingson-Yeager.
Present.
Hemmingson-Yeager present. Apologies. Representative Hicks.
Present.
Hicks present. Representative Hudson.
Present.
Hudson present. Representative Katiza Batun, thank you.
And she is running a little bit late because of the weather, but she should be here momentarily too.
Representative Lee.
Present.
Lee present. Representative Nelson.
Present.
Nelson present. Representative Perez Vega.
And she's presenting a bill in another committee.
Representative Zelensnikar, sorry.
Present.
Zelensnikar present.
Thank you, Ms. Killian. We do have a quorum. Our minutes are a little bit delayed, so we'll be catching up on several sets of minutes early next week. So again, members, there are three bills up today. They've got a couple of amendments, and we'll kind of move things along. I'm expecting, just in terms of the order, to shift things around I guess we pretty much do have the order correct on the agenda. So we'll be, thank you, Ms. Colburn, for handling that. So House File 150, members, we had reviewed on, I think it was last Thursday, so a week ago. We took testimony and had some discussion. The plan is to consider several amendments to that. Of course, any further discussion there may be, and then the plan is to have a vote on that bill to bring that back up. And then a bill from Representative Perez Vega, and then another one for me in House File 13 for child care assistance. So we'll consider a bill to stabilize a child care early learning sector in the short run in the first bill, invest in preschool in the second bill, and in child care assistance program in the third bill, and go from there. So I'm going to ask Representative Hansen to step in. We're missing both the vice chair and my former vice chair. But Representative Hansen, I know, will be able to help ably.
Hello, everybody. Thank you, Chair Pinto. So next on our agenda is House File 150. And reminder, members, we heard testimony on this last week, and we said we would bring this up this week. And so Chair Pinto moves that House File 150 be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Is that right, Chair Pinto?
That is, Madam Chair. Yeah, I think you as Chair are taking HF 150 back, taking it back up. And then, yes, that will be my motion to re-refer to the Committee on Ways and Means.
So. Thank you, Chair Pinto. And it sounds like you also have an author's amendment. Is that right?
Madam Chair, I do. And I'll explain it now. So I guess I move the A2 amendment. And then to explain it, Madam Chair and members, the A2, you'll see on the first page that it makes a change to the early learning scholarship program to allow children from birth up to be eligible for that program. I should note that the same income eligibility requirements apply. This is something that has been considered, in fact, passed multiple times over the past bunch of years. One of the reasons to make this change in connection with this particular bill is, remember that the goal here regarding HF 150, just to sort of recenter us on that, is to make sure that families have child care and early learning through the end of the biennium. So we'll be passing a budget shortly that will take effect July 1. But in the meantime, we want to make sure that families have the child care and early learning that they need even before that is enacted. And so what the amendment does is it furthers that investment, expands the eligibility to make sure that that the infants and toddlers are eligible as well. It deletes the section relating to the child care assistance program. That's at line 2.15 on the amendment. You remember that when I presented the bill on Thursday, I said that that was something that would be coming, and promises made, promises kept. We're taking that out because it was a little bit complicated to address that at this time. And instead, we're investing an equivalent amount of $40 million that was going to be invested in CCAP and scholarships is now being invested in the scholarship program. That's line 2.17. Line 2.16 is a bit of an adjustment to the amount being put in for those stabilization grants to match the amount that it's our understanding from DHS is necessary to make those grants at the level they've been before. Now, this is a longer explanation than usual for an amendment, but feels like it can help recenter us on the point of the bill in the first place. And I'd ask for members' support, and I know we'll discuss it further with the discussion of the overall bill.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. So on the A2 amendment, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. Chair Pinto, remind us about your bill, if you wouldn't mind.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. So members, again, so House File 150 is really addressing just an emergency in our child care and early learning system that was present well before the pandemic. And this is admittedly a very short-term fix. We're just trying to address an issue before July 1. What the bill does as amended is that it invests $40 million again in the early learning scholarships, allowing that to apply from birth up. These are for low-income families so that they can have child care and early learning in the next couple months. I'll just note, we have a worker shortage. We have huge needs when it comes to child care, we should be meeting that need now with the resources that we have. We also have those stabilization grants that have kept the sector afloat. I'll direct members' attention to the stabilization grant report that we had the other day that talked about the huge number of providers for whom these monthly grants have been absolutely critical. Those grants are scheduled to reduce in March, and what the bill does is simply says that they should not reduce in March. They're going to keep at the same level through the end of June, and then we'll consider as the budget moves forward. So I hope that members can support this, and we may well have a discussion on it and look forward to that. Thanks, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. Just members, is there any discussion on the bill? Go ahead.
Thank you, and thank you, Representative Pinto. I wanted to ask a question on keeping the centers afloat. I'm 100% in favor of child care stabilization, for the record. But I have a question. When I look at page 5, we've lost 700 family child care providers. And from 2021 to 2023, one child care center we lost, and we had 5 certified child care centers that we lost. I'm concerned about the family child care centers providers, especially in northern Minnesota. I'm hearing from people they have closed. I know people who have closed. And so while in larger communities, child centers may be more common, and there may be more of them, I'm concerned on what the equity, you referenced that this past stabilization kept the centers afloat, which clearly it did. How do you see this affecting the family child care providers? Is it equal? Is it equal in the way that they're going to have access to the funds in northern Minnesota for the family-based child? I want to make sure family members in the entire state have access to both models of care. One shoe doesn't fit all feet. So I've utilized centers, and I've also used child care, family child care providers, equally great. But I want to make sure that there's appropriate grants for family-based child care providers. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks, Representative Lesnikar. If I said to keep centers afloat, that was a really bad misstatement, and I'm sorry. I thought I said providers, but if I did say centers, then my apologies to you and certainly to the amazing family child cares that are out that do this incredible work in our state. That was not deliberate. The idea is to keep providers afloat, including family child cares. I'm not sure what document you're referencing when you said page 5, but I don't know if you still have it, but the stabilization grant summary report we received on page 3 of that report, it talks about these grants. It's about 7,500 providers have received them. Of those 7,500, more than 5,000 have been family child care.
So well over two-thirds of the 7,500 providers to receive grants have been family child care providers. They've participated at about the same rate as centers. And just as a reminder, 96% of providers receiving these grants, which I assume includes lots and lots of family child care, have talked about how these were really helpful in keeping them open and operating. So if you want to keep family child care going, we want to keep these grants, again, just going at the same level through the end of June. But no, everything we do, we want to make sure we're supporting family child care. They do incredible work. And if I used the word centers before, that was a mistake, and I apologize. Thank you, and thank you, Madam. Thank you, Representative Hansen, for filling in. That was great, and good to have my former vice chair, Representative Cortez Ratoon, there. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Slazkin, any further comment?
No, thank you very much.
Members, any further discussion? Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Pinto, along those lines of the 5,000 family child care providers who received grants, do we have any data on how the base grant amount averages out for those family child care providers as opposed to the child care centers?
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Hudson, for the question. I'm looking in the report on that. I will say that the way we structure those grants is to be based on people. So each person doing the work gets an equivalent amount. I know that family child care providers have expressed concerns saying, hey, listen, we're often working more than 35, 40 hours, which they are, work incredibly hard. On the other hand, you know, there are people in centers working really hard too. We did talk about trying to adjust. There's some proposals about adjusting, you know, based on if you work more than 40 hours, it's like 1.25, 1.5. But right now the structure of the grants is to say if you're a human being doing in this work, you get an equivalent amount no matter what setting you're in, and so the amount is the same. And I think the full amount was $430 a month, which is not nearly enough, but that's where we're at, and at least I want to get back to that level.
Representative Hudson.
Just as a follow-up, thank you, Madam Chair. This is admittedly a short-term fix, as you've stated.
Right.
I'm concerned that if this becomes the model for permanent budgeting going forward, that the payment structure that you just outlined that's based upon employees and the number of employees that are in a center is going to remain in place. I'd be interested in whether you've placed any thought into shifting to a child-based funding model as opposed to employees and child care centers.
Interesting question, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, it is an interesting question. Thank you, Representative Hudson. One challenge with that, with doing it based on the child, is that this issue of, you know, child's in for a few days, or for a few hours, you know, part-time, or child is there for some number of days, but then out for some number of days or some number of weeks, and sort of how to calculate that is what I recall. That's at least sitting right here, that's what I recall about the reason that we ended up going based on an employee or a person delivering the service. I don't want to use the word employee because that actually is a center-based term, you know, and we want to make sure to include family child care. So as I recall, that was part of it. I will just, you know, full disclosure, if you hadn't noticed, the governor's budget proposal 2 days ago did propose to continue a version of these grants monthly going out. So either that's, you're delighted by that or concerned by that, or, you know, either way. But the point is, there is that proposal from the administration. We'll be considering those proposals too. I don't know. I think that one also is structured based on the employee or the person delivering the services. But I would be open to something else because we want to make sure to recognize just the volume of learning and care that are being provided. So I'm certainly open to talking about how we structure that. I do think it's important, though, that ultimately the funding go to supporting the person doing the work. Right now, 70% of these grants goes to the person. Under the administration proposal, I think 100% is proposed. We do want to make sure the people doing this work have such low compensation that the funds are going straight to them. So that would be important to me. But happy to continue working with you as this goes forward.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Members, any further discussion to the bill?
Yeah.
Representative Daniels.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Chair Pinto, for this bill. I just want to start where we have some common ground, the expanding of both eligibility and funding for early learning scholarships. This program was first piloted with a modest $2 million appropriation authored by former Representative Jennifer Loon, who is a longtime champion of early education. Early learning scholarships are child-friendly, program flexible, and parent-directed. That's kind of why we like those. We believe in empowering the parent to do more with nurturing child than a bureaucrat living and acting as the child in the child's best interest. So in this area, we have common ground. I wish I could express some enthusiasm for the stabilization grants. First, these are only intended for a one-time stopgap measure in federal funds during a nation state emergency. And there have been real expectations for the program becoming a model for the long-term funding solutions. There should have been more thought given to ensure programs would fairly benefit the providers. And then, as Representative Hudson mentioned, the data suggests while the grants may have helped stabilize children's care centers, we lost 700 family child care providers. This is what happens when government, and rather than parents, are picking the winners and losers. And last, Representative Zankara had some interesting comments on how the staff is, how the funding is done. And we talked about that before, the FTEs rather than the actual children. So my hope in this bill is that, it's basically a bill in progress, and we can make it better as it goes through the process. But I do thank you for your concern and your hard work on that. But for now, it'll be a no on the bill.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm going to consider, maybe I'll ask Madam. So thank you so much, Representative Daniels. I'll maybe respond to those in my final comments. I want to make sure, I'm assuming we may be done, but just in case we're not, and then I'll go back to
any last questions or comments on the bill. Representative Zalesnikar.
Thank you for your work, Chair Pinto. And my question is just on the family-based child care centers. Your thoughts on the star system. They have a ranking system. It looks to me that they have to have 3 or 4 stars in order to be eligible for the grants. And I'm wondering if how COVID has affected in family-run child care centers, because the money follows employees, if I'm hearing you correctly. There's less employees working. And so some of the compliance pieces I'm hearing from child care providers on the family side are overwhelming. And so their star rating might not reflect the actual experience to the family member or for the child in child care. And so I want to make sure that they're not going to not get the grants because of a star rating system that has unfortunately eliminated them for things that maybe are not indicative of things we would intend. I just would love your comments on that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks, Representative Zalesnikar. So first, just for folks, I know that many of us are kind of new to this. So the Parent Aware System is Minnesota's system for quality rating and improvement for child care and early learning. And there are a series of stars kind of that denote progress through that system. And I should say there's criticism, I think, from a number of angles on that system. And we spent some money, and right now there's an evaluation going on in that system. But that's a system that we have, and a lot of strengths to it as well. Representative Zalesnikar, I think it's the case that the programs are eligible for scholarships if they have any stars in the system, not just 3 or 4. But I might direct that to Ms. Mock to just clarify that for us with House Research.
Ms. Mock?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, Representative Pinto, you're correct. Any star rating can receive a scholarship.
Okay.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so, Representative Zalesnikar, so that way it's not just 3 or 4 stars under Parent Aware, it's any stars at all would be eligible. I should say that I considered as part of this making any licensed program, having any licensed program qualify for 1 star. It was really complicated, just to be honest, to try to figure this out for the next couple months. But that may well be something that we want to consider as a committee. And if you're interested in that, Representative Zalesnikar, I'd love to work with you on that. For now, we've kept the system in place, the scholarships in place as they are. We want to make sure it's working just as well as it can. So thank you.
Representative Zalesnikar.
Thank you.
Very good. Members, any further questions before I allow the chair to finish up? All right. Chair Pinto.
All right, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members. So it sounds like we have agreement that we should invest significant funds, the $40 million in those early learning scholarships to get childcare and early learning for families right away. So that part's good. And then I guess that gets me to say we need to make sure there are childcares for those families to go to. A reminder again that 96% of childcare providers receiving the stabilization grants said that the grants were helpful in keeping them open and operating. And actually, 81% said they were very helpful. More than half of providers who applied for these grants said they want to apply for them in the future. As many providers as we've lost, family child care and others, the fact is we would have experienced a much greater collapse if it had not been for this work. Members, we're talking about a couple months to just keep these programs afloat. And I'll just say if this dollar amount was okay up until, you know, for the first year, I would suggest it should be okay for the next couple months to make sure that we don't lose our providers. We didn't have the testifiers today. They were last Thursday. But if you remember what they said, some very powerful testimony that this is critical to keep this deeply, deeply underfunded sector afloat, because without this, our worker shortage gets even worse and we have all kinds of problems. So, Madam Chair and members, I hope that you can bring yourselves to support HF 150 as amended, and I will renew my motion that HF 150 as amended be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Chair Pinto renews the motion that House File 150 as amended be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. And members, we will move to a vote. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, say nay. Right. The motion prevails, and the bill as amended is re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Next on the list, we have House File 456 from Representative Perez Vega. So please head up to the chair, and Mr. Chair will return to the chair seat.
Okay. Representative Perez Vega moves that House File 456 be referred to the Committee on Education Finance. And so, Representative Perez Vega, thank you so much for bringing this bill forward. I should say this is something that I've been really excited about for a long time. I sure hope we can finally make this happen. So, Representative Perez Vega, if you want to describe your bill, and we'll bring up your testifiers and go from there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Maria Isa Perez Vega, and I represent District 65B, which covers this capital city of St. Paul and the city of West St. Paul. I'm presenting HF 456 relating to making a permanent expansion of voluntary pre-kindergarten and school readiness plus programming for permanent funding towards preschool for our Minnesota children. As a mother to a 3.5-year-old who turns 4 this April, I can express to you directly the importance of ensuring our young children are prepared for their first day of kindergarten. As a youth worker who has provided a multicultural curriculum through performance arts and music for students throughout the Twin Cities, some of my finest moments in my practice have been providing access to our early learners before they reach kindergarten and witnessing their full potential into adulthood thriving onto higher education. Research shows that the investments in early childhood pay dividends in long term, setting our children up for great success in every area of life. Our pre-K age children in Minnesota deserve quality care and the great benefits of a preschool education more than ever in the aftermath of a global pandemic shutdown in which most infant to toddler kids, like my daughter, were limited the ability to interact with other children their age until most recently. There is a great need across the state for pre-K, and it will be a great asset of preparation towards advancing a positive emotional, verbal, and physical environment that will welcome and bring comfort to the future pupils of our educational institution student population. We need to ensure all of our students are ready for kindergarten. And preschool is a gap-closing strategy for our young students of color and indigenous students to excel in our educational settings. Preschool opens the opportunity for children to spend a great amount of time with other kids their age and develops interaction skills with adults and teachers outside of their home, building an environment on how to make friendships, communications, and cooperative conversational listening skills. Preschool pre-K allows our children to participate in new activities with peers and build skills on how to express certain emotional frustrations and challenges before kindergarten. Studies have shown the variety of activities of a preschool education provides, helps, and constructs children's language and literacy skills, physical and movement development, communication, math, science, and approaches to learning the arts and music as a way to express themselves. Learning the alphabet, sounds, reading aloud, and along with creative hands-on crafts, story times, and projects, boosting the child's skills to build goals and express their imagination. Our Minnesota preschool kids deserve high-quality education to support their imagination and cooperative development with skills and opportunity to enter on a prepared readiness for their kindergarten class. There are simply not enough pre-K opportunities for our Minnesota families to choose from, and this would allow consistency in ensuring funding is available for current and prospective pre-K programs. I ask members of this committee to support our children and state's opportunity to ensure preschool will remain with permanent funding in order to continue to serve our Minnesota children's opportunity to thrive and allow a comfortable invitation to the beginning of their educational journey. Muchas gracias, Chairman Pinto, and members of the committee for hearing out why I believe all should be in support of HF 456.
Thank you so much, Representative Perez-Vega. Thanks for carrying this. We've got a couple testifiers. Mr. Sellers, I think, is the first one. You can come on down and introduce yourself, share your preferred pronouns if you're comfortable with that, and then just proceed with your testimony. Thank you, sir.
Good morning. My name is Jason Sellers. I'm the Director of Community Education for Burns Early and Savage, and all of early childhood programming is supervised, led, and implemented out of our office. Chair Pinto, Representative Vega, and members of the committee, really appreciate the opportunity to testify on behalf of the Minnesota Community Education Association regarding House File 456. Voluntary Pre-Kindergarten, or VPK, is a community-based program that offers families across the state of Minnesota an opportunity for their children to equitably enter the K-12 system ready to engage in learning. Simply stated, VPK programming is vital to both the academic success and overall health of our incoming kindergarten students. However, we think it's fair to ask, what is the actual impact of VPK programming on our students? The Burnsville Egan Savage School District has the fourth largest VPK program in the state of Minnesota. In our upcoming school board meeting next week, our community education department and my staff will share the results of our VPK program and the impact on our students entering into kindergarten. In ISD 191, we administer the FastPidge assessment to all children entering kindergarten. The early reading component is used in kindergarten and first grade to monitor rates of student growth and accuracy of early literacy skills. The overall percentage reported for each student is based upon a composite score of a bunch of stuff I'm going to say now, and you'll probably forget it, but it's okay. It's based on phonemic awareness skills, including concepts of print, onset letter sounds, letter names, and other letter sounds, all of which are in the kindergarten assessments and relate to third grade literacy standards. Students scoring at or above the 40th percentile on FastBridge are considered to be making expected progress based upon national norms. A couple of data points for you. The number of students we have assessed in our school district is 601. Out of those 601 students, the percent of students that met or partially met expected benchmarks that participated in our voluntary pre-K program through our district was 80.3%. I'm going to say that again. 80.3% of all students that went through our VPK program, they met or exceeded standards. The percent of students that met or partially met expected benchmarks in early reading skills who did not participate in ISD 1 voluntary pre-K program was 62%. Of that 62%, the vast majority were white and attended fee-for-service programs. Additional positive impacts for students and families enrolled in VPK include increased access for students to attend preschool, preparing students for kindergarten through active play and engagement, especially in social-emotional learning, while also providing a strong foundation in language, literacy, and mathematics. Collaborating with student support services, which post-COVID is much needed, these support services include special education, multilingual support, social workers to support families, and identifying and supporting student family needs in a proactive versus a reactive approach. Finally, there have been numerous partnerships that have been developed with families to support their early learners at home specifically and ultimately in that transition to kindergarten successfully. Our community education department and our school district enthusiastically support Governor Walz's and Lieutenant Governor Flanagan's recommendation to increase funding to benefit children and young people's social, emotional, physical health. In addition to the important changes embedded in this bill, we applaud and acknowledge the need to invest additional resources to increase access to infant and early childhood mental health services and for school-based early childhood programs that include workforce shortages. VBK programming simply offers student and family supports that are standards aligned, the curriculum aligns with third grade literacy, and transportation for all students. This type of holistic support has produced very good results and very tangible results for our students and families. Without this bill and the funding mechanisms provided to increase access to VPK programming for all students in Minnesota, many families, particularly in our district, would struggle to participate in any preschool at all on a fee-for-service basis. School readiness dollars are limited, and now more than ever, families do not have the discretionary income to pay for fee-based preschool experience. Stabilizing these VPK funds would ensure that school districts across the state are positioned to build on these important programs while continuing to align curriculum to kindergarten and third grade literacy standards. In conclusion, the Minnesota Community Education Association supports parent choice and student access to safe, healthy, and high quality VPK early childhood education and care, and we appreciate this bill and the opportunity to be here to advocate for VPK.
Thank you so much, Jason Sellers. Thanks for your work for our kids. Craig Anderson is up next from my own school district and that of Representative Perez Vega, so we're excited about that. And if you can introduce yourself or your preferred pronouns, if you're comfortable with that, and then proceed with your testimony.
Good morning. Craig Anderson, the Executive Director of Teaching and Learning for the St. Paul Public Schools, he, him, his. And I want to first thank you, Chair Pinto, and representatives for considering this bill. The St. Paul Public Schools fully supports making VPK funding permanent. In St. Paul Public Schools, we have 261 voluntary pre-K funded seats. That they are at 8 of our sites, and that is the that is the pre-K program at those 8 sites. To date, the VPK seats serve the children and families whose free and reduced lunch rate is well over 80% at each of those sites. Thanks to the funding stream, the St. Paul Public Schools offers full day, 5 days per week funding and programming where children have access to a licensed teacher, enrichment specialists, nursing, bilingual supports, and evidence-based instructional materials. It should be noted that each child completes early childhood screening within 60 days of beginning school as well. In our four-star parent-aware rated program, children and families are welcome to school with family enrichment engagement supports that recognize the gravity of the transition from home to what may very well be their first entry into the public school system. Teachers and paraprofessionals receive job-embedded coaching that supports data-driven instruction in social, emotional, language and literacy, and mathematical concepts. Children in the SPPS, St. Paul Public Schools, pre-K program routinely achieve the academic targets that show preparedness for kindergarten. We're very proud of the achievements of the pre-K students. By making VPK funding a permanent part of statewide budgeting, SPPS will continue to support children and families' readiness for kindergarten. We know investments in early learning work. We know that knowledge imparts a duty to act. House File 456 converts that knowledge into action and secures over 260 VPK seats for each year for St. Paul's youngest learners.
Thank you so much, Director Anderson, for your testimony and for your work. Appreciate it. Stephanie Youngberg is our final testimony signed up to testify, and I think had driven a decent distance to do so. So we really appreciate you doing that. And so if you can identify yourself, share your preferred pronouns if you're comfortable doing that, and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Perez-Vega, and the community members. My name is Stephanie Youngberg, she, her, and I am the superintendent at East Central Public Schools. Thank you for allowing me just a few minutes today to discuss the impact that voluntary pre-K has had on our children and our families. The East Central School District is rural and encompasses about 750 square miles. Our current student population in K-12 is about 725. We are located in northern Pine County and have a significant population receiving free and reduced lunch, about 55%. Our VPK enrollment over the last 4 years has averaged about 43 students. VPK has allowed our early childhood program to offer preschool 4 days per week, full days. This program is free to families, and we are able to provide children and families with affordable, accessible early learning experiences that will build the solid foundation of learning. When our children are able to come to school for full days for VPK, we are preparing their bodies and their minds for learning that will come in kindergarten as well as the rest of their educational journey. Through funding provided by VPK, we are also able to provide children with transportation to and from school and a free breakfast. Students also have access to lunch, which ensures that their bellies are full. When students are hungry, they are not able to focus on academics. Our free and reduced lunch families are benefiting from not only early education experiences for their children, but their children are also getting the meals that they need to prepare their brains for the school day. One area that might seem to be small, but is a benefit to the preschooler's day, is the ability to learn and grow in our outdoor learning spaces, at least once, if not twice a day. Research has shown that providing outdoor learning play to our children, they are able to access physical activity, which also encourages a healthy lifestyle, play with others socially, and collaborate together and be in touch with nature, understand the world around them. Learning even occurs while these littles are dressing for outside time, especially during our wonderful Minnesota winters. Dressing for outside helps them learn self-care skills and practice fine motor skills. This is time well spent. Parents of our preschool children have taken this education opportunity very seriously. Our preschool classes have great attendance throughout the school year. Children are consistently in school. By instilling an understanding that consistent attendance is important to our children and their education, parents are getting the families in a positive routine right from the start. When our children are at school, they are able to receive mental health services from co-located licensed providers within our building. Many students are able to benefit from these services because of the VPK funding. For many of our families, time away from work and hurdles with transportation would otherwise prevent access to this critical service. Our families and their littles also have access to county services within our school community, allowing easier access to dental services, county mental health services, and a proactive instead of reactive relationship with child protection.
Superintendent, I ask you to wrap up relatively soon.
Sure, absolutely. I would like to share that our kindergartners use the TS Gold testing standard. Our students that tested last spring going into kindergarten, we had 88% of our students meet benchmark on social readiness, 94% meet readiness on math, and 100% of our kindergartners showed readiness in reading. The successful learner equation of ready families, ready schools and programs, ready communities, ready state, and ready systems equals success for our learners. It is not the responsibility of children to be ready for schools. It is the responsibility of us as adults, of our schools, our programs, our communities, and for our state to provide opportunities that are equal and appropriate. By providing preschool for our children, we are setting our students up for success, ensuring that they are prepared for kindergarten and have long-lasting social-emotional success. This funding is important, and it is needed to be predictable and stable for our students.
Thank you so much, Superintendent.
Thank you.
Just a couple quick follow-up questions. The East Central District is what communities? And perhaps you said that and I missed it.
We're multiple communities. Sandstone, Askove, we go all the way up to Duquette. So we go from about the 35 corridor all the way to the Wisconsin border.
And in your district, how many slots, how many preschool slots is that?
We have used all of our slots, and it's averaged about 40. We've been up to 53.
Okay, great. Thank you so much. I should have asked, I guess along the way, members, if there are testifiers and you do have questions for them, I'll figure you'll raise your hands. Otherwise, we'll just keep folks moving on. But thank you so much. So
thank you for your
appreciate it. Are there any other member of the public who wishes to testify on this bill? And it doesn't look like it. Okay. And before we move to member discussion, I'll just note for folks, because it's a little bit confusing, these are slots that every 2 years disappear, expire. And so all this is doing is keeping preschool slots that have been offered for a number of years in school districts to have them be able to keep offering them. Part of the reason that I wanted to move on this quickly was because we've heard from school districts saying for families to be able to plan, for school districts to be able to plan, it is way, way, way easier to know about this in the spring rather than having to wait until the summer. And we keep on kind of playing rope-a-dope with districts every 2 years. These slots keep on getting renewed. So the idea is that if districts have been offering preschool, let's at least let them keep offering preschool. And with such a difference with testifiers. So in any case, discussion from members, member questions or points at all. Representative Nelson. Yeah, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm just wondering, how are the slots allocated to schools? The East Central School, that is in my part of it's in my district, not completely, but, you know, they have, I think currently, Ms. Youngberg said they have 43 students out of about 725 K through 12. I didn't do the math on it, sorry, but, you know, it's about 5% if I'm off the top of my head quickly. So I'm just kind of curious, how are the slots allocated? And then I guess that's the first question.
We'll do the first one. So I think that MD, somebody from MD probably may be present who can help us with that. If not, I know Ms. Mock can take a stab at it. But we may have, I thought, oh, somebody's coming down. Okay. Be able to give us a bit of an answer. I will say I think that 40 some out of 750 total students is actually probably a pretty good percentage compared to some school districts. And I think that's one of the reasons your superintendent, and we had said, by the way, the superintendent, she did not have to drive down, and she said, no, this is super important, I want to make the drive. So if you could please introduce yourself, Ms. Morrison, and answer the question if you can.
Shana Morris, Assistant Director of Government Relations at MDE, and I'm actually just on the line now with our Director of Early Learning, getting the answer for you.
Oh,
so pardon. Momentarily.
It may be that somebody, if there's somebody else in the room who can answer that question. In the meantime, maybe Ms. Mock, and if she's aware, I'm not sure if she can. I may be testing you a little bit with that, Ms. Mock, but give it a try.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I can go ahead and start, and Ms. Morris can jump in whenever she's ready. The seats are allocated. The schools in the state are divided into four groups. So there's Minneapolis-St. Paul in one group, there's urban areas in one group, rural areas in another group, and then charter schools in the fourth group. And then seats are allocated to those four groups based on the number of kids in each group who are eligible for free and reduced price lunch. And then within each group, sites are prioritized within each group based on the number of kids who are eligible for free and reduced price lunch, and then the distance or the availability of 3 or 4 star parent aware rated programs, child care programs in the area. And so then there's a priority list for each group, and then the seats that are allocated to each group are just go down the priority list.
I may actually clarify the last bit. If there are fewer 3 or 4 star rated programs, then there's going to be more VPK slots, because the issue is that right? An inverse relation.
Yes, Mr. Chair, that's correct.
If that's helpful. So Representative Nelson, follow up
on that? I think that makes sense, and you know, it's probably one of the reasons why in East Central District they have the ability of, you know, I think it's, what, 750 square miles. It's a large area of the district, and you know, it is a lot of a lot of state forest, but you know, at the same time, it's a, you know, highly uninhabited and a long distance to you know, and the availability for childcare. But and then just kind of a secondary or another question on that. I see that, you know, there's a on 1.14 shows like 7,160 students available, but then talking about the funding, the levies are, let's see, looking at what page this is on. The levies are calculated off of, if I'm understanding it, off of the 4,000 seats. Maybe if there could be just a little bit, are the levies calculated based off of the total number of 7,160, or is it the additional 4,000 seats, or?
Thanks, Representative Nelson. I know there's going to be a little bit of explanation coming from Ms. Beckel. Before she goes, I'll just note, we fund 3,160 seats permanently, and then there's 4,000 seats that are the ones that keep on expiring. Okay. They have a different name called School Readiness Plus. It's part of the whole complication of all this. But there is language at the end of the bill that is a little bit complicated relating to this, so let Ms. Beckel, our House Fiscal Analyst, describe that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Yes, so the levy language in this particularly pertains to the 4,000 extension because the levy is already dealt with and set for the existing 3,160 seats. I can discuss this matter further if you have further
questions. Maybe we'll see if Representative Nelson has other questions. But yeah, Representative Nelson.
No, I think that makes sense because it was just a little unclear on how that was. But the 3160 is under current levy, and so then the additional 4,000 that is allocated ends up pulling it under levy as well.
Is that right, Ms. Beckel?
If I understand it correctly.
Yeah, let's get to Ms. Beckel.
Mr. Chair and members. Without this language, it would be under levy. Okay. Effectively, with how it works, this would impact the levy. But the House has sort of an unspoken rule about levy targets. So generally speaking, the Education Finance Committee, which this would go to next, has a rule that their levy target is $0. Meaning that the goal is to not impact property taxes with legislation from the Education Finance Committee. Okay. So because this bill would result in levy impacts, this language has been input in order to use state aid instead of creating levy impacts. So it would be, we don't have the fiscal note yet, of course, but it's saying that the state would then pay for it instead of impacting property taxes.
And Representative Nelson, it's probably worth noting, too, because it's kind of confusing. This language relates in a way, it's not part of our jurisdiction, it's education finance. Part of the reason we don't have a fiscal note is that we're really reviewing this kind of from a policy perspective. We hand it to that committee, and then they are handling that part of it. But Representative Nelson, anything else?
No, thank you. That was helpful. Thank you.
Good. Thank you so much. Any other questions from members at all? Representative Cortez-Bertun.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Perez Vega, for carrying this bill. I think it's so important that we continue to offer a variety of options for families. I know you're a mother. I've got four kids, nine and under. My first term, when I was the vice chair of the Early Childhood Committee, I had a 4-year-old, a 3-year-old, and a 2-year-old, and so that preschool time frame was really challenging, and I know it can be so for so many families. I think, you know, one of the things that I, Mr. Chair, just alluded to, actually, we have this kind of patchwork of options, and I think that, you know, it's really important to consider family choice and what makes sense for each individual family. Increasing the allotment of voluntary pre-kindergarten spaces across the state, I think, is so critical because we know we have a wait list. We've got families waiting for this service. And, you know, I think when we consider some of the conversations on regulations and restrictions and family child care and center-based child care, school-based preschool, all of these sorts of things, you know, I grew up in the state of Wisconsin, and my first year after college, I actually worked as a migrant recruiter and ELL para. In a really small rural school district, and I had a 4-year-old kindergarten class, because in Wisconsin, 4-year-old kindergarten is actually in their state constitution. So I think, you know, when we look at the strong history of supporting families and children in Minnesota and across the Midwest, this is one of the ways where, you know, we can help these families catch up for families who are in a little bit of a tougher point financially, and I think that it just is incredibly important. So I appreciate you carrying this bill this year.
Thank you, Representative Cortez-Bertun. Representative Hicks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative. I actually was invited by my local community to a event to hear about all of their early childhood programs, but this was an area that they really stressed how important it would be for this to be permanent funding for them. In Rochester, this comprises of 108 seats, so to give you kind of context because of all of those very complicated factors. But our district, parents spoke about how incredibly amazing all of our early childhood programs were, but this was something that they were really passionate about, how important making these permanent really would be for our community. So I just wanted to say thank you from our community for bringing this forth, and I'm excited to vote yes to make sure our schools have what they need.
Thank you, Representative Hicks. Any further questions or comments, members, and otherwise? Oh, Representative Zlesnikar. Yeah.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative, for offering this. I think child care and pre-K is really important, and I think in the school districts it's great to have. My only question is, in the rural areas, and for kids who may be in family-centered or child care centers, from my understanding, there are some pre-K programs that they want to have available. So some of those children may not be able to leave those programs to attend another program because we are in a workforce shortage. So I just ask us as members to think about how we can have creative support to our existing child care centers who are also teaching in those settings to assist families, because going to transport children and be at work, and when we're in a workforce shortage and all the issues I'm hearing, I just ask us to be creative as we look at long-term funding solutions for these models, because many I'm hearing from, their children are in the child care center till they go to kindergarten, and they are not able to access for a variety of reasons, not income eligible, but it's all critical for these children, all children, to be ready. So I just ask that we look at these models for best practices. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Lesnikar. Maybe there's a good chance to just note, you know, we just passed a bill to have early learning scholarships, including for four-year-olds, and that's in family child care and child care centers. We're about to hear a bill for child care assistance for families, including four-year-olds. We've got those stabilization payments for those. So we are addressing a number of different approaches, and I totally agree we need to do that from a variety of perspectives. And this bill is simply to say that if districts are offering preschool, let's make sure they can keep doing it so it wouldn't disrupt things. I guess not passing it would disrupt things, because then we would lose these preschool slots. Any further questions or discussion? And so going to the bill's author, Representative Perez Vega, for your final comment.
Thank you, Chairman and members of the committee. I just want to highlight and give thanks to those who give testimony, and thank you for representing the district that I represent, our school district of SPPS, in speaking on behalf of those Tier 1 educators who really depend on having the accessibility in the workforce through child care, through preschool. Me being a Tier 1 advocate, as I am a Tier 1 instructor that has worked for preschools throughout both St. Paul and Minneapolis public school districts, we are in a need for our youth to be able to excel. And it is just such a joy to see these kids grab onto an educational setting at such a young age. You see their potential in their eyes. You see how it helps not just themselves and their peers in an educational setting, but also the families, the encouragement that it gives to our families, and in particular our BIPOC students that really need that in the disparities that we face post this COVID-19 shutdown. Muchas gracias. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And Representative Perez Vega, I actually jumped the gun. Lee Daniels did want to make a statement. My apologies to you, bill author, and to you, Lee Daniels, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a couple comments to wrap this up. And I apologize for going after the bill author. Apologize.
That was on me, sir.
You know, this is another area where early learning scholarships could be a solution. While the VPK programs target school sites instead of students, scholarships are targeted on the household need, which I think is, you know, a better solution, to be honest. Another concern I have is where the largest disparities in funding per pupil in the districts. The program replicates the flawed formula system. We all know how bad that is. Some districts getting around $6,000 or $7,000 per pupil, and typically the metro getting $14,000-$15,000 per student. So it follows that formula. So I would think that the having the scholarships would follow the child and make it a little bit easier to make the investment. And while I think scholarships would be a preferable approach, I think potential compromise would be to make permanent funding for school readiness plus and with some formula reforms to ensure fairness in funding and considerations for portability, school readiness plus targets resources to children with both the highest need and the potential for the greatest benefit. So again, to the author of the bill, I appreciate your bill. Sorry I did not go after you, but I'll be voting no on this bill for now.
Thank you, Lee Daniels. Representative Perez Vega, thank you so much for working on this. We have districts that are offering pre-K and we have families that are expecting it, and you're helping to make sure to meet that expectation. I'm so grateful to you for that. And I should note, too, that this will, to a certain extent, simplify our efforts because we'll make sure that we just have these permanent slots as we continue to invest in scholarships, as Lee Daniels referenced, and CCAP in our next bill, et cetera. So I want to move directly to a vote. With that, Representative Perez Vega renews her motion at House File 456. You re-refer to the Committee on Education and Finance. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed, please say no. And with that, House File 456, the ayes have it, and the bill, the motion passes, and you're on your way to Education and Finance. That's great. And so I'm going to swap out with Vice Chair Representative Keeler and present the bill. Madam
Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that House File 13 be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means, and I do have an author's amendment, the A2.
All right. Chair Pinto, do you want to explain the A2 amendment?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. So members, the A2 does two things. One is that the bill as drafted had the effective date for this proposed rate change be in November, and part of the reason to move this as quickly as we can is so that we can get the rate change to kick in as quickly as possible so that families can get the care that they need and providers can get the compensation they deserve. So this simply advances the date to early August, which is our understanding of kind of the earliest that the rate change could go into effect given when the bill could pass. And then the second change is just to clarify that providers can offer discounts or scholarships to private pay clients, that they're allowed to do that. There is some concern that if the CCAP rates are increased, we certainly want to make sure that providers are allowed to still provide discounts to their private pay clients. And so would like to have both those changes made and ask for the support on the A2.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. Moving the A2 amendment to get into the bill format that you would like, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Chair Pinto, please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, members, House File 13 would finally put our state in compliance with federal directive under the Child Care Assistance Program. So that program has significant federal funding, some state funding. It is a program that is designed to allow to give parents who are low income, who are working or in school, the support that they need for child care so that they can be working and going to school and taking care of their families. Pretty basic stuff. One of the requirements under that program is that states set a rate based on a survey of providers' rates, a rate that gets paid. And the federal government asked that rate be set at the 75th percentile on that survey. What that means is that families will then be able to choose from about 3 out of 4 providers in a given area. We want to make sure those rates are set at a decent level. Children get high-quality care. We've heard lots of discussion, of course, about how low the compensation is and the challenges for people providing this really, really critical service. There are a number of states for the 75th percentile. Our state has not been. This is something that we've considered and passed out of the House repeatedly, considered for years. And so the proposal is to simply set those rates as really where they should have been all the way along at the 75th percentile. We're moving this bill quickly, as I said, in order to, for a couple purposes. One, in order to get those rates to kick in as quickly as possible. And also because this is something that we've had discussions about for a long time. And it is important that we begin to recognize how critical this sector is for our economy, not only now for parents and employers, but also in the long run for the benefit of kids as well. And so let me think if there's anything else I want to add. I guess that that's all, Madam Chair, and maybe would have my testifiers come up if that's okay with you.
Yep, I think that's a good next step. We'll start with Karen DeVos. Yeah, I'd love it. That's perfect. Go ahead. Welcome to the committee. Please start with introducing your names, the organization you're with, and pronouns if you would like.
Thank you. Good morning, Representative Pinto, members of the committee. My name is Karen DeVos. I am the owner of Little Learners Early Childhood Centers in Ada and Halsted, Minnesota. We're small rural communities in the northwest part of our state. I have 25 years experience in the early childhood field, previously serving 16 years as a family child care provider and the last 9 years as a center owner, director, and often preschool teacher. I'm here today with my daughter Thea, a recent Hamline graduate who has grown up immersed in the child care world and is back working in our sites as a teacher and assistant director before she heads off to law school in the fall. I brought her with today because my children have become the face of our business. Without my teen and adult children pulling together to work at Little Learners while going to high school and college, we wouldn't have enough staffing to keep our classroom doors open. I'm here today as a small business owner, as a board member for the Minnesota Child Care Association, and as a mom to voice my support for House File 13, raising child care assistance base rates to the 75th percentile of current market rates and updating them to new market rates every 3 years. While I don't believe this one change will fix problems with accessibility and low wages in the early childhood field, I do believe that it is one step that we desperately need to take.
Here are just a few facts about CCAP. So the Child Care Assistance Program, otherwise known as CCAP, is dependent by families in 87 counties across Minnesota. Greater Minnesota providers rely especially on CCAP as population density dictates that to be viable. A provider must be able to serve a mix of families across the income spectrum from low to medium and high because there isn't enough of one demographic to form a solid client base for business stability. Base rates at the 75th percentile of current market rates for community is the minimum recommendation from the Department of Health and Human Services. Rates at the 75th percentile mean that a family using CCAP would have their tuition covered at 3 out of 4 providers in the area, giving them actual choice for where to enroll their children. Automatically updating the rates during every 3-year market rate survey cycle would give providers confidence to invest in their programs. Whether that means compensation, expansion, or quality, knowing that rates wouldn't stay stagnant while costs rose. And it's important to note that only 8 states have CCAP rates lower than Minnesota, and Minnesota can definitely do better.
As I look at the last 25 years, my career, how this field has evolved, and how I have evolved, I'm so proud. We look at children differently now. We see these first 5 years as a vital time in a child's life. Unfortunately, we are still not compensating those who do that important work. The longer we continue to ignore things like child care assistance, the deeper the hole we dig. If I can't afford to pay appropriate wages to my staff, if I can't afford to pay those very important people who work with our children every day, they're going to go somewhere else. Almost half of the children at Little Learners are considered under middle income. Raising child care assistance rates would mean higher wages for my team. It would also mean that my kids would have a break. And it would show everyone in Minnesota that Minnesota is really ready to make an investment in our children. That is why I, Karen DeVos, and my daughter Thea, on behalf of Little Learners and the Minnesota Child Care Association, support House File 13. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Are there any questions?
Thank you for your time and testimony. It's always fun to see you. Generational duels in this work. Good luck in law school. Next up, we have Gospel Korda.
Thanks so much for being here.
Hello, welcome to the committee. Please start by letting us know your name, organization, and pronouns if you prefer.
Okay. Good morning, Chair Pinto and members of the committee. My name is Gospel Korda. I'm an advocate for Kids Count on Us. I've been involved in the child care sector in different roles for several years, primarily as a provider. I'm here to speak this morning in support of HF 13 and raising child care assistant program, or CCAP, rates to the 75th percentile of the current market rate. This would make a huge impact on the ability of child care centers and providers to provide high-quality care we know that our young Minnesotans deserve. I've opened a child care during the pandemic, and during which time, because we weren't able to actually hire qualified teachers, we ended up closing down. Most of which of my staff and families are low-income immigrant. A lot of them are 200% above poverty line. So it was very hard when you work hard for something like that to close down because you're not able to actually afford paying your teachers and keeping them. Our biggest challenge was finding staff, like I've just mentioned. The staff we could find were not teacher qualified, so training them fell upon us. Unfortunately, retaining them after we've invested our time and resources into training them, we also lost a lot of staff to nearby Amazon or other industries that, you know, could pay them a little higher wages, and so that was also very challenging. This is an industry in crisis. We very well need investment to recruit, retain our workforce now. Teachers are leaving childcare because of the lack of funding to provide living wages. An increase in CCAP rates will provide much needed funding we need to find qualified teachers. The current CCAP reimbursement rates are the 40th percentile for infants and toddlers and the 30 percentiles for preschoolers. Imagine purchasing a cart of groceries at the grocery store filled with high quality nutritious food, and when the cashier tells you the cost of your purchase, you cannot respond, thanks, I will pay 30% of the market rate for this cart of groceries. So why do we tell child care providers that we must provide high quality care for children on CCAP for significantly less than what it costs them to do so? Providers cannot tell teachers that they will only be paid 30% of the market rate. Not one of us in this room would agree to do a job for 30% of the salary that most others are receiving. An increase in CCAP will also give families more access to more child care options. To create more child care slots, child care centers need funding to hire, train, and retain staff. An increase in child care teacher wages will draw more people to the child care workforce. I urge to raise the CCAP rates to the 75th percentile for Minnesota's child care providers, teachers, families, and kids. Thank you. Thanks so much.
Cheers from the crowd. Thank you for your testimony. I agree. We absolutely need to invest in the individuals who invest in our next generation. Discussions to the bill. Members, any questions?
And I don't know, Madam Chair, if there's any member of the public.
Oh, public. Any public testimony?
I don't think so. Okay.
Seeing guess none, not. Go ahead, discussion on the bill. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Touching back on the conversation we had a couple of days ago regarding the unfortunate history of the CCAP program from about 5 years back, where there was what I think can be fairly described as an obscene amount of fraud taking place. We heard testimony from the Department of Human Services Office of Inspector General, who was not able to provide an estimate of the full scope of the fraud which took place. There was some back and forth amongst members disputing what the actual amount of that fraud may or may not have been. And just to provide some clarification, the Office of the Legislative Auditor, even though they reported that they couldn't confirm that $100 million number of fraud, it was stated by the CCAP fraud investigator that the state's CCAP fraud team generally agree with Stillman's opinion. That was the individual who originally blew the whistle about the fraud, about the level of that fraud. So there was general agreement that it was somewhere close to the number of $100 million, which is a huge percentage of the amount of money that was going out the door. And when we asked, when we inquired of the Inspector General what we can expect in terms of processes that have been put in place and how they are going to prevent that type of fraud from happening in the future, we were met with the claim that such information can't be provided due to ongoing investigations, which we didn't have time to delve into that too deeply. But what I'm concerned about here is that we're going to turn up the spigot in terms of funding. We're going to automatically renew it every 3 years. And with the level of scrutiny that we've had thus far, we have not been able to even identify the exact amount of fraud that took place 5 years ago. And now we're removing a mechanism for scrutiny by having this automatic renewal of funding every 3 years. I guess my question would be, what's your level of confidence that the issues of fraud have been addressed in the CCAP program? And that going forward, these funds are actually going to reach the people who are providing the high-quality care that we agree needs to continue.
Chair Pinto?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Hudson. So my level of confidence is very high. I work as a prosecutor, so any human endeavor has human flaws, right? But my level of confidence is very high. I will direct your attention, Representative Hudson, and the attention of other members to a couple documents. I sort of thought we might have handouts of these, but they are on the committee website, and they were emailed and highlighted to folks, which are some handouts from past hearings. I want to remind folks, we're talking about allegations made 5 years ago, a report that came out 4 years ago. What the documents are that put out there are some handouts provided by DHS at past hearings that points out where were we in 2019 and then where were we in 2020 and the changes made. A variety of changes that include on that page things that happened. So I just want to remind you, in 2019, enhanced record keeping requirements for CCAP providers. All this happened 4 years ago, 4 years ago. Clarified absent holiday billing requirements, a uniform method for calculating attendance record overpayments, increased penalties for intentional program violations, clarifying DHS's authority to impose provider sanctions. The disqualification period was increased. The burden of proof was increased. We funded enhanced monitoring of centers. We funded staff to work on that. We funded multiple BCA special agents. Anyway, the point is, I could go on for a long time. All that was 4 years ago. When you talk about a dollar amount from back then, it's just not true. The $100 million, and I don't want to get too much in this four-year-old report, but the $100 million was, it was just found not to be true. And the investigators in question, and this amazes me as a prosecutor, prosecutors told the OLA that these investigators, quote, wanted prosecutors to charge individuals before there was enough evidence. So here's the thing. I have great confidence. I'll say one thing is nobody more than me wants money to go to babies and families, right? I'm on record on that. I don't want money going to anybody else. I want to go to babies and families. That's why we spent hundreds of hours in 2019, and actually a heck of a lot of money, too, to revamp the system to all kinds of changes. Every year since then, we've had a series of updates. There should be nothing stopping us now from making sure to have providers receive the money that they are, that they should be to do this incredible work, to be supporting families based on allegations from 4 years ago that were discredited. And I will say the biggest problem with the integrity of CCAP is the fact that we're not actually funding CCAP, and the families are on a waiting list waiting for CCAP. So, but the short answer is that, yes, I have great confidence in it, and I really would encourage, I think that you can too, and maybe when the opportunity arises, we can review those past documents from several years ago showing all the changes that have been made. Thanks, Madam Chair.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I'll just point out that I think it's a bit of an overstatement to say that the number was discredited. Again, the CCAP fraud investigators stated that they generally agree with Stillman's opinions about the level of fraud. But the fact that we have to sit and debate what the number is, again, I think is indicative of a concerning problem. We should know what that number is. We should have absolute certainty about how much of the money that we're appropriating from taxpayers is actually going to the purpose for which we're appropriating it. And the fact that we don't have an answer to that question casts a shadow of doubt upon the wisdom of just opening up the spigot without those controls having been proven. And what I mean by not having been proven is that, indeed, 4 years ago, a number of mechanisms were put into place, but they haven't been adequately tested. They were delayed in terms of their implementation until September of 2021. And so we've had a little over a year to actually see whether or not these mechanisms are effective. And the answer we got from the Inspector General is, I can't tell you because there's ongoing investigations. I would think knowing what the content of those investigations are, the nature of them, the scope of them, would be something that we would want to know before we decide we're just going to push auto pay on CCAP funding going forward.
Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I mean, Sir Representative Hudson, I'm just comparing to working with cops, which I do in my other job. I mean, you know, St. Paul Police can't, and other Ramsey County law enforcement agencies aren't going to be able to say, you know, publicly, this is exactly what's happening in certain ongoing investigations. That doesn't mean we don't adequately fund them to do those investigations, and then we don't adequately fund the things that's connected to it. I guess I'm not, you know, how much crime is there precisely in any one of our communities? You know, part of the nature is that sometimes that ends up being hidden. The critical thing is that we make sure that we put resources in to address that, to make sure that there are controls, to make sure that it's being investigated. And what I'm telling you is that in fact has happened repeatedly. And actually, at least one of the things is being distributed. Thanks, Ms. Colbert, for that. You know, and again, this is old. This is multiple years old. I disagree with you. They haven't been tested. This has now been multiple years. It's true the pandemic caused challenges for all kinds of things for us. But no, I'd say this has been tested. Again, the problem, the real challenge in CCAP right now is that we have kids waiting to receive child care assistance and families that are having to have kids be taken care of by the new boyfriend or by the neighbor down the hall rather than somebody who is licensed and who knows what they're doing for providing care and learning for kids.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Cattizo-Watoon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Chair Pinto, thank you for your ongoing leadership on this issue. I think I was the only other member of the Early Childhood Committee back in the 2019-2020 biennium. And I mean, while COVID did cause lots of issues in lots of different areas, we had DHS come in and tell us exactly how they implemented
right. The
legislation that we passed in 2019 in 2020 before the legislature even went remote. So we had them come in. They had a beautiful tag board presentation thing that was like this cycle, and it was like all of the spots throughout like the process of application and payment and whatever it was. And then they had highlighted little squares and little triangle spots in there that said, this is exactly where we've now put these stopgap measures. And then they came to us on Tuesday and they said, now we've recovered over $350,000. We're there continually monitoring the fraud. I don't see this increase in rate payment as an ongoing thing that we don't have any measures in place to kind of, if something comes up again, and now we have all these additional measures in place, hopefully we're mitigating that. If anything comes up again, we can again address that. But I think that ultimately this is a workforce issue. We have providers coming to us, we have parents coming to us and saying, we can't pay our staff, we can't hire more staff because we're only paying this much. I mean, they're giving a service that is critical, that we all know on this committee is critical to the growth and development of our littlest Minnesotans, and we're paying them pennies. And so how can they expect to stay afloat? And how can we expect parents to somehow go back to work to fill all the jobs in all the industries that, we have this worker shortage right now? It's the childcare workforce is the backbone of every other workforce. And if parents don't have a safe and affordable place to send their children, they're not going to be able to go back to work. So this is common sense to me. This is a missing piece of that patchwork of our childcare fabric that I spoke about earlier. And I cannot see how somebody could vote no.
Thank you, Representative. Other questions, comments? No? Okay.
Lee Daniels.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First off, thank you, Mr. Chair, for this bill. I know your heart's in the right place. We've talked about it multiple times. I just kind of echo Representative Hudson's thing. We come back to Inspector General, who both two or three of us were asking, what the number was of the fraud. If it wasn't $100 million, what was it? And we had absolutely no idea, and yet we've already reimbursed or gotten back $360,000 from fraud. So they were getting money back for some of the things, but we don't know what the total extent of the fraud was. There's nobody that can give us a number. I also asked the Inspector General, how many investigations are ongoing, and she said she couldn't answer that. So there's a really uncertainty on my side of the aisle of if these things have actually been, taking place. And then since the $100 million of fraud was kind of brought up, kind of reminding everybody about the Feeding Our Future fraud, which is in 2021, 2022. So after the CCAP fraud was discovered, I, with our taxpayer dollars, I'm really leery of, skeptical, I guess, of putting ongoing funding, like Representative Hudson did, said, ongoing permanent funding, until we really know that this has been handled. And I know we got a couple of pieces of literature out there, and that's great, but Feeding Our Future came after all the CCAP fraud, so it just kind of muddies up the waters. So my wish is we'd pump the brakes on this and get some answers from the Inspector General. So for today, I know your heart, I know this is a well-intended, but there isn't this cannot support the bill at this time, and so I'll be voting no, and I hope we can have further discussions and come to a remedy. I know that child care centers need funding, and it's critical we do that, but I don't see maybe possibly throwing fuel on the fire if there's more fraud is going to help. So once we get that all straightened out for sure, I would be on board to go ahead. But for now, I'll be voting no. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Lee Daniels. With no other discussion, we'll send it back to you, Chair Pinto, for final.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Lee Daniels, and thanks all for the discussion. You know, I'll say, yeah, so there is, I would agree, it sort of feels like the waters are muddy in some ways, but I think that's just because we're not seeing the need in our communities. Child care assistance is really important in every single one of our districts. It's actually more important in greater Minnesota disproportionately. Lee Daniels, you referenced, you know, we need to address these concerns about the integrity of the program. That's the whole point. They were addressed. That doesn't mean we're not done. I actually am expecting the administration to be coming with more proposals. I invite any member of this committee. Like, if you identify there's things that we need to continue to improve, please come to me. And if you're not sure, let's work that out. But the fact is, that's what happened. There were a series of reforms, a really massive series of reforms. That was a number of years ago. They haven't been implemented. They have been working. And now it's time to fulfill our promise to kids and to families in Minnesota of paying the rate the federal government's been expecting us to pay all the way along as they've been funding this critical program. And so, members, there's nothing in a four-year-old report that should cause us to not act today. And so I would urge members to be supporting this increase in rates to 75th percentile and to make sure that we get kids and families on a better path for their benefit and the benefit of all of our communities as well. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks, members.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. With that motion to re-refer House File 13 to the Committee on Ways and Means.
As amended, Madam Chair, I think.
As amended,
yeah.
Yes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed say nay.
No.
Motion prevails. The bill as amended is re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Before we adjourn, Chair Pinto.
Yeah, thanks. Just quickly, so members, a couple comments. On Tuesday, we'll be expecting to be hearing a really exciting proposal to address homelessness in our state that's going to be brought by Representative Keeler. I just want, if you'll just indulge me for 1 second here, I just want to note what's happened on Tuesday and today. In the next few months, we're going to be, by moving bills through committee, we're going to be feeding people who are hungry. We are going to be taking action on early care and learning across a variety of fronts in an area that historically has been pretty divided, folks being concerned about scholarships and child care and preschool. We're making sure that all these approaches are invested in so that families and kids are invested in as well. I have to say I'm really, really excited and pleased. And I thank you very much, and I appreciate the discussion we've all had, including with my colleagues on the GOP side of the aisle. Let's continue to focus together on getting young kids off to the great start they deserve. Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. With that, our next meeting is Tuesday morning, January 24th at 8:30 a.m. Everybody drive safe. We're adjourned. Mm-hmm.